And then in the debate as to what we ought to do, I felt probably it would be best to use a summary format in terms of presenting the material and discussing it. But in so doing, I hope you'll understand that the initial process has to do with identifying relevant evidence and beginning to look at various pieces of evidence, which I would identify by category at this stage, and begin drawing possible inferences from various pieces of evidence. For example, we talked about 13.1 and the possibility that 13.1, which of course would involve context, not segment context, but intersegmental context, involves a matter of syntax and inflection on plus the subjunctive. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but have not love, and one could draw two possible inferences from that. One, that you have here a simple condition, in which case it's possible to speak both in the tongues of men and of angels. And the possible inference might be that the tongues of 14 involve some kind of heavenly angelic tongues. Another possible inference would involve the contrary to fact condition, which means that he's talking about a hypothetical thing, but it's really impossible, as, for example, the next statement may indicate, in which case, of course, angelic or heavenly languages could not be involved here. And you'd have to look for some other explanation of the language. You see how you look at the evidence and you begin drawing possible inferences from the evidence with regard to its bearing on the answer to the question that they're dealing with. Are we clear on that part of the process? And you go through the evidence this way first. Now, as I say, we'll do it in terms of a summary format, and the possibilities in this summary format would be those that emerge from what I've just described as a process. But before we look at those, and before I ask you as to what some of those are, and I'll ask you for some of the evidence out of which they grow, let me indicate first that I'd like to know whether you have any questions about this initial stage of the process. It's a matter of identifying relevant evidence and begin looking at that evidence from the standpoint of possible inferences having a bearing on the question.
I have a question in going into scriptural testimony. The difference between that and evaluation. When you move to evaluating your interpretation of the text, you're going back and looking at some of the similar evidence that you used here. Can you help me with that?
Well, there's an overlap between the two. In fact, there's another overlap, and that is between the interpretive process and the evaluative process. And then the correlative process, talking about biblical theology. So there's an overlap between these. The difference has to do with focus and purpose. Your purpose in looking at scriptural testimony at the stage at which we're at here has to do with interpretation. The other has to do with evaluation, and the other has to do with biblical theology, which is a phase of interpretation when you're interpreting the Bible as a whole. So the difference is one of focus or purpose, although you may be dealing with, in some cases, the same passages. And of course, if you've looked at the passages already, doing it at the stage of interpretation will enable you better to do it at the stage of evaluation and even in biblical theology. So that simply illustrates the fact that this process is interactive, and there are overlappings between these various phases. So when you draw this out in terms of procedures, you're not making hard and fast lines between all of these different steps. Any other questions? Okay, let's get before us then some of the main possibilities here. Let's say we'll treat this in kind of a summary format. What what are some of the possibilities that emerge from your studies? Let's just have various ones of you respond. I wonder if you would respond to that first for us, please, Steve. That's one possibility, at least.
One possibility is some form of stack gathering.
All right. Some form of ecstatic utterance. And basically lingual sounds.
Sounds of no meaning, at least not in the American sound.
Yeah. So this would be lingual sounds. Now give us one piece of evidence that points in that direction as a possibility.
Well, 14, 15, where we talked about that the tongue involves praying in the spirit and not in the mind. That view is just a little bit more rational content to the movement of tongue, which is what that view is.
Well, could one be speaking, however, in a language even though one does not understand what one is speaking?
Yeah.
I'm really wondering whether there is a strong inference made from that distinction between mind and spirit with regard to this area. And in fact, one might argue, we're beginning to argue evidence now, let's say, that verse 6 would indicate that there is rational content. As he says, "Now, brethren, if I come to you speaking in tongues, how shall I benefit you unless I bring you some revelation or knowledge or prophecy or teaching?" And of course, what he's moving toward is this whole matter of interpreting in tongues in order that there may be a revelation, etc. So there is rational content, although the mind may not be involved in producing that rational content. Now, that could very well be a language. In fact, that tends to point more toward a language than it does to this. Although there is some evidence, here's some reason for using this. There are clearer statements, I think, here to point in this direction. But anyway, that's... In fact, let's pick up one or two perhaps clearer ones. 14:2 and 14:4 13:1 does not necessarily involve lingual sounds over against other possibilities. We're already beginning to suggest other possibilities here, but 14:2 says, "For one who speaks in the tongue speaks not to men but to God, for no one understands him." Now, if that means that this is never or not at all addressed to men, and it's impossible for anybody to understand this, then chances are it would have to be a lingual sound, if that's the way you view that statement, as over against some kind of language that at least might be understandable, should the proper person be around. Let's see. Now, there are other ways of viewing 14:2, but anyway. And 14:4, "He who speaks in the tongue edifies himself." Now, of course, here we have to ask whether he's not assuming something in light of what we said about the structure of the whole and light of what he goes on to say in verse 5. In other words, whether he's saying edifies himself if there is no interpretation. Because he goes on to speak about interpretation, verse 6, which makes possible the edification of the church. So, what we're indicating, you see, is that even in some of these cases, you have various possible inferences, depending in part on how you interpret the evidence. Now, the other possibility is what, Steve?
I broke it up into three possibilities.
Okay.
The other two mean that the divine language, the language is the divine language, and the other one is human language.
All right, I would take those as basically one language with these two distinctions, and some kind of divine or heavenly or spiritual, however you want to describe it, and the other would be a human or a secular language. The common thing here is that you have a language as over against merely lingual sounds. Okay? Now, does that pretty well cover the possibilities here?
You're saying that speaking to God does not involve language?
No, quite the contrary. You could be using some kind of divine heavenly language and speaking to God, but it's a language nonetheless.
Right.
Take this people.
So what I'm saying is that there's really no grounds for these ecstatic utterances at all at this point.
Yeah, well, we pointed out some of the grounds, and some of the grounds are used.
So, are you distinguishing between those in unintelligible and
Well, that's my next question. Now, when we talk about language, what do we mean by language in contradistinction to the lingual sounds? Well, what do you mean like by language, Steve?
One thing I think of is that in language, the sounds have a distinct meaning, whereas in the lingual sounds, then each given sound doesn't have a distinct meaning at that time.
All right, and then
the person could, the sound has a meaning, whether or not I understand what that meaning is, it has that meaning. And if I know the interpretation of the meaning, then it would be not meaningful.
And it would need to have a constant meaning.
Right.
In other words, there are two, that's one distinction. In other words, you'd have a vocabulary in language. Vocabulary means simply the combination of certain sounds which carry certain meanings. And you have syntax, sentence structure. Those are the two major differences between language on the one hand and simply lingual sounds on the other hand. Now, by the way, we should see here, some of the evidence tends or seems to support both. And when you get to the definition of term, which we'll begin with here simply because it's rather simple, the term glossa, of course, can refer to what various things? Yeah, it refers to the physical tongues, so it involves the use of the tongue in any way, which could include lingual sounds of any sort. So connecting the physical tongue with this concept would allow possibility that lingual sounds could be involved. On the other hand, of course, the definition could also support this in that the physical tongue is the means by which languages are spoken. So glossa lends itself to either one of these possibilities. And by the way, if we were taking the evidence possible inferences approach, which is the initial step, we'd simply come out with two different inferences, you see. That's what we're doing here, right? Okay, let's begin now by making the strongest possible case for, initially, this point of view. What is the strongest possible evidence one can cite for this lingual sounds point of view, which doesn't have any constant vocabulary or syntax? Let's have some volunteers here. Paul?
I was going to suggest verse 23 of the 14th chapter. It's maybe not the strongest, but I think it's certainly some solid evidence here. Therefore, the whole church assembles and all speak in tongues, and outsiders and unbelievers will they not say that you're mad? And that this is something that makes people, an outsider, think that this is insanity.
All right, let's put that down. That would be conscience. 14:23, and you draw the inference that since this phenomenon would lead these outsiders to conclude perhaps that insanity was at work here, that therefore what was involved must have been lingual sounds and not languages. Now let's forge that link between your inference and the answer to the question. Why not, for example, might not the same be true if they were speaking foreign languages people could not understand? Supposing you had let's say a congregation of 50 and each one was speaking a foreign language, which to a person coming in might sound like these lingual sounds, might not that too produce the same conclusion?
Yes.
Same?
Would that too just under the
Yes, they thought people thought what of the people, the individuals in Acts 2? They were drunk. So that's questionable evidence. Because it could be countered. And here you have this matter of self-debate. You see this matter of rebuttal. And this now, the value of that is that if you don't see various possible inferences, for example, this possible inference, when you look at this evidence, along with this possible inference, then you can see the other possibility when you engage in this rebuttal, the self-debate, you see? So, let's just counter and say, this could be used as an argument for this point of view as well.
It goes back to verse 22, you've got to understand what that means.
All right, and let's indicate something of the problem we have when we do it the way we're doing it. But I thought it might help for us to get at least let's hold that off, particularly if you feel that might point in another direction. Do you feel that might point, for example, in this direction? Is that what you're implying?
No, I'll make a point in that direction.
Which direction?
On the left or outside.
Okay, give us that argument then. Why 22 points in that direction?
Well, let me go over the motion. Okay, going back to 21 also. I think the argument on the language side, I believe, is that 21:22 refers to the languages in Isaiah 28:11.
Yeah, let's hold off a moment on that one. So I'd like to get the major arguments for this point of view.
What I was doing, I was getting my basis for answering back to that question. That's the way I approached it.
Okay, but then we'll have to put it over there, too, because that seems to point in that direction as well.
Okay.
In fact, we might have someone counter it. Go ahead, Frank, as long as you're focusing here.
Tongues of 14:21 are strange tongues, different Greek words and glosses, and carol glosses.
Now, what is a different Greek word?
Hetero.
Hetero.
Hetero, okay.
Yeah, hetero, other, or strange.
Yeah.
That's over against what?
Glosses.
Well, you have glossa used, so where's the different word used?
Well, the different word is, we're talking about strange tongues, and then we're talking about tongues. Well, the different Greek word is used then.
Yeah, but it's a combination of hetero, glossa. So glossa's involved.
Yeah.
Other tongues, besides the ones that they understood, these
the
people of Israel.
Well, the hetero refers to languages. That's the background on that word. It refers to human language. So we don't have, we're questioning whether tongues are or not.
In other words, you're saying that the compound form hetero plus glossa refers to something else besides glossa.
Well, that's a possibility. That's what I meant. They're just different.
I was hoping we'd get the strongest arguments. I don't think that's one of the stronger ones, but let's put it down. Context here in terms 14:21. This quotation from Isaiah 28, which uses a combination of heteros plus glossa versus merely glossa, is what you're arguing. And there's a difference. You're saying this means languages, and since there's a distinction between the two, the latter must not mean languages. That's what you're arguing.
That's the start.
Okay. Continue with the line of argument.
There's an argument from Moody that's associated with this. Hebrew from Isaiah 28:11-12 says they would not hear. Here Paul puts it in future tense, indicating even then they will not listen to me. Then applies to the conduct of the unbelieving people in regard to the tongues themselves in gospel times. Thus the kind of tongues will fail, as did prophetic preaching in Isaiah and the evangelistic preaching in Paul. Tongues, ecstatic, cry, sign of judgment. In this case, this is a negative sign as compared to the positive sign which is used in the second part of verse 22. Tongues then are not used for conversion, or used for evangelizing, and that combines in the 14:23. Therefore, tongues are not languages, but static utterances, posoleia, unintelligible tongues, praise, and thanks. I've got an argument against that too, but that's all.
Okay, well, someone analyze what Fred has indicated here. I won't try to put all that down. Let someone respond by way of analysis. And we're going to get caught up, I see, because of what's happened in this debate back and forth. Someone analyze what Fred has said. Run in, make an analysis of it.
My concern is that at this point, he has not taken into consideration the possibility of synthetic parallelism. I'm sorry, not synthetic, synonymous parallelism in the context of Isaiah 28:11, in which second phrase elaborates on the first. So the strange tongues is elaborated by saying lips of foreigners, which refer to human languages. So the argument would not be justified.
In Isaiah, it's by men of strange lips and with an alien tongue, the Lord speaks to his people.
And then the rebellion of the fact that they do not hear is not necessarily because the tongues don't work, but I believe it's indicated that the people did not want to hear. They did not want to respond to what they heard in the strange tongue.
All right. Whether you have a parallelism there is debatable. But anyway, certainly by men of strange lips and with an alien tongue are to be taken together. And one is to be interpreted by the other, so that and by the way, it has to be interpreted also in the broad context, which involves what? What's 28 all about? What's the prophet doing? Yeah, judgment against whom? It's debatable as to whether he's talking about Ephraim at this stage or the people of Israel, Jerusalem, I mean. But in any case, he's talking about basically what here? The captivity and the fact that foreigners, if it's Ephraim, Israel, it's the Assyrians, if it's Jerusalem, it's the Babylonians, will come in and speak in foreign tongues. And when the people hear these individuals speaking in foreign tongues, they will realize the prophet's prophecy has come to pass, and the judgment is upon them for their sin. And by the way, that's why I have serious question about the argument that would play on the wood verse 12, and by the way, the statement in 1 Corinthians 14 is a condensation. It's a very rough paraphrase of this whole thing. But chances are you cannot play on the wood as involving something past as over again future, because note the future tense is used in 11. The Lord will speak, yet in effect they will not listen, is what he's saying here in terms of the future. He's prophesying about the future captivity at this stage. It hasn't happened yet. See, and he's really indicating there, that's the way Paul is using it, by the way, that they would not listen. They will not listen.
What's the argument against the parallelism? It's a poetic form in the Greek, and of course in Isaiah it's also a poetic form.
Yeah, the question is whether you have a parallelism as between by men of strange lips and with an alien tongue, the Lord will speak to his people. It's not a parallelism. You have some kind of poetry, obviously, but whether you have synonymous parallelism is another question.
What is the alternative to that?
Well, the alternative is really what amounts to a synthetic parallelism in which you have really the first stick involving the first two lines and the third stick involving the Lord will speak to this people. At least the Lord will speak to this people as an addition to the previous two. Not maybe an incomplete synonymous parallelism. That's a possibility. Okay, any other responses to what Fred has said? Now, summarize again. I wasn't quite able to follow the evangelization argument that you were using, Fred.
This kind of tongues will fail, and did the prophetic preaching in Isaiah and the evangelistic preaching in Paul. Tongues then stay, cry, sign of judgment. Tongues then not used for conversion, preaching, or evangelizing, seen in 14:23. But prophecy can be two sides or tongues and prophecy. Prophecy, interesting, I get in the second part of 22 is that prophecy is the positive sign, tongues are the negative sign, and the prophecy brings in the believers. That's the argument for conversion in that idea.
How would you respond to that? How would anybody respond to that?
I think I did.
Well, I'd like to have others get into an analysis of that.
Well, I could agree with everything you said. It's just around language, though. I mean, just the fact that the tongue is something that's rejected and it's an angry sign wouldn't necessarily mean that it has to be static method.
Well, that's true, particularly when you look at the meaning of Simeon and sign. But it seems to me that the argument twists around what is being said in 22, and that is that a sign is, tongues are a sign for unbelievers. Prophecy is for believers. And of course, you have to ask, what is a sign? And incidentally, when you study scriptural comparative usage, you get into scriptural testimony. Say, take the use of sign in the fourth gospel, where its primary use is found. You find precisely that the sign is for unbelievers and for the evangelization of unbelievers. Now, the problem with 23. Is using tongues without interpretation, which of course would cause unbelievers not to become believers, but to become more unbelievers, because they think these people are mad. But that's without interpretation. Whereas prophecy is primarily designed for believers, although he goes on to indicate, but if prophecy can also have a value for unbelievers. In 24, if all prophesy and unbeliever or outsider enters, he's convicted by all. So that's the way I would analyze that argument. I think it flips around precisely what's involved here in 22, in light of that, the use of that semeion sign. Unbelievers. Has someone used that argument, Fred? Have you heard that argument used?
Yes. Yeah, it's part of our argument that they use.
That's interesting. Because it's so obviously erroneous to use that kind of argument that it seems to me that wouldn't strengthen the case very much.
Is there any justification at all for the use of the word ecstasy or ecstatic? I know a lot of commentators use that term, and I don't know why.
Well, it has to do with the fact that the experience is the result of some kind of possession by the spirit, which really takes the person out of oneself. It's really a spirit possession kind of thing.
That's a question, though, isn't it?
Well, it's a question, but there is evidence to that effect, going even back to the prophets. In fact, the word for the prophets, Navi, probably comes from the whole concept of possessed by the Spirit and giving this ecstatic utterance, which transcends any human kind of experience, normal human kind of experience. So there's good evidence for that. But anyway, what this emphasizes is the role of the Spirit, which is superhuman. And now, there's also connected with that the element of enthusiasm. Some kind of unusual, even bodily movements, expression that is involved with speech and is related to how the speech comes about. So there's some evidence for that ecstatic, although on the other hand, you have indications here that it's supposed to be completely under control. A certain number ought to do it and do it in a certain sequence. So apparently there's some human control involved in it, which would not be the case if you're simply subject to the control of the Spirit, you know. Although, you know, you might argue that the Spirit himself is orderly, so he won't seize one and cause that one to speak in tongues if someone else is also being seized by him and caused to speak in tongues. So that argument can be used with regard to this matter of order, but he addresses, this is an exhortation, and it's addressed to the individual, which probably means the individual has some control over it. Okay, any other arguments that could be used for this point of view? Aaron? I'm looking for the strongest ones now.
Hey, this is my strongest argument.
Your strongest argument. Good, good.
I'd like to call the class attention to verse 6 through 12, that paragraph, when he uses the analogies to help explain what he's talking about. Specifically to verse 10, there are doubtless many different languages in the world and none of them without meaning. Why, if this was human language, why if tongues is human languages, would he use the analogy of what I believe to be a human language? In other words, verses 10 and 11, to me, speak of human languages, phono. And I can't see why Paul would use an analogy dealing with human language, because it speaks of foreigners, to try to explain what tongues is all about.
It depends on how it's revealing. But
See, the term foreigner clues me into the idea of human language. Why would Paul use phono and everything else, everywhere else use glossos?
I think verse 7 is a little stronger than that.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can follow your argument there, Aaron. I see you intermingling several things, and maybe in your own mind the connection is clear. The connection hasn't come through clearly to me anyway.
Okay.
You know, you're playing on the difference between glossa and phoné, or is the argument having to do with analogy? The assumption being that if you have an analogy, one element of the analogy must be of a different order from the other element of the analogy? Is that...
An analogy, as I understand it, is simply given to help one understand something else. I give the analogy, a tree is tall like the Empire State Building. I'm simply using the Empire State Building as the stress of the tree is tall. An analogy is something given to explain something else.
The question would be, does an analogy require that you compare two things that are essentially of different orders? Or can you have analogies between things of a similar order?
You could. A sycamore tree is taller than a oak tree, whatever.
Yeah.
We could.
Or say a maple tree, or say an oak tree is like a chestnut tree. And that both retain their leaves a long time. See, the argument is weak if you assume an analogy has to involve two things of different orders.
Okay. I agree, but I don't think that's the main thrust of my argument.
Okay, what is the main thrust
of it? Paul is using the analogy of foreign languages to help explain tongues. They are two different thoughts.
And now how does the second statement follow from your first statement?
Aren't you just asking, you know, why didn't he use inside the analogy the word again?
Well, you believe in chapter 13, don't you? I seem to have been last hardly. At least as far as explaining it is concerned.
Well, you see, verses 7 and 8 there deal with putting the heart in a bugle.
Does your argument then from 11 and 12 follow from what he says in 7 and 8 and the comparison that makes there?
Well, I see, Margaret, in 7 and 8, he's giving an analogy between the flute and the harp and the bugle. If there's not a musical composition to make sense out of the sounds that come out of a flute or a harp or a bugle, who'll know what the piece of music is about?
Okay, but I'm asking, does your argument that you're using for 10 and 11 follow from the analogy in 7 and 8?
It is a type, yes.
It's a different kind
of analogy.
I should say.
It's not dealing with harps and flutes and bugles. Now he's using foreign languages. If someone speaks in a foreign language and there's no interpreter there, how can you understand foreign language?
Okay, but the two analogies are related?
Yeah.
Okay, then perhaps so that we can see clearly, you can explain the first analogy and then redo the second one, and then we'll follow what you're saying.
The first one about harps and flutes and bugles. If I play a flute, if I just play a C and a B, I mean, several notes, but you can't tell there's any song to it. What, you know, no one will know what the song's about. But if I don't play an arrangement, if I don't play the music market, I'm just making up my own little song, and it's not a song at all.
I have a question. I play the trumpet, and I can play a blurb or a note. And I think what he's talking about is the blurb, not note.
Yeah.
Which, but that helps out.
Right.
Because then he's saying that language is a blurb.
Yes.
So in the case of an instrument, for example, the bugle, if I play reveille and start out with a blurb, nobody's good.
That's right.
They may wake up, but they won't continue. So.
Yeah, that's right. And Paul's saying you've got to play the reveille if you want people to know what you're playing.
Okay, but it's not the song that's important, it's the note.
Yeah,
right. I think that's what Paul's saying.
Okay, yes, that's right.
And then we go along with your argument.
Yeah. And
well, how would that go along with your argument, and is the argument valid? How would that go along with your argument?
Well,
I mean, what is a, in a language, what is a blurb and what is a note?
I think the emphasis we're making here is that if you don't play the reveille, if a bugleist doesn't sound a reveille, the warriors won't know what's going on.
Right, that's an indistinct sound. There's over against a distinct sound. Now, how does that relate? How is that similar to what happens with regard to languages? What's an indistinct sound with regard to a foreign language?
Well,
that's isn't that the point? Isn't that the whole point here? The indistinct sound of a bugle is the indistinct sound of a foreign language. Why? Because both are intelligible, unintelligible. Now, why is the latter unintelligible, and when is it unintelligible? When it's not interpreted. See?
Yeah.
And when is it intelligible? When it's interpreted. In other words, here again, you see, you have to be careful how you use analogies. This is a very tricky area, as we pointed out in interpretation. The question is, how are the two analogies related, the instrument analogy and the language analogy? Now, in the instrument analogy, he distinguishes between indistinct sounds and distinct sounds. Now, by the way, indistinct sounds, you call it a blurb? Is that what you called it? whatever you call it, are indistinct why?
Because it's not playing a known, something familiar.
Yeah, well, not necessarily, but anyway, it has no meaning. I mean, it's just a honk. A distinct sound has a clear meaning. Now, by the way, he's using this in relation to the use of instruments in a certain way. He's talking about battle, you know. And there they had a certain sound that had a certain meaning with regard to going into battle. Now, if you know, a guy has an instrument and just blows any old sound, they're not going to go into battle because it doesn't mean let's go to battle. But if he plays the other note, it has the meaning that the battle is ready to begin and they're ready to fight. So that's the difference between them. Now, how is this analogy like this one with regard to language? Well, when is a language indistinct and without meaning? Yeah, when it's foreign. In other words, it's unintelligible.
Put it on here.
Yeah, it depends on here, that's right. But it also depends on the speaker, in that the speaker is speaking his foreign language and not interpreting it for the ear. That's why he says you have to be careful with interpretation. On the other hand, when a language is distinct and has meaning, when, by this we mean foreign to the hearer, for it doesn't have meaning, when this foreign language is interpreted, then, of course, it's distinct, it has meaning. this has no meaning, like this indistinct sound of an instrument, and this has meaning.
But
what has that got to do, my question would be, with supporting this argument? Okay. That would be the question. In spite of the use, by the way, of phonon in 1410, and by the way, here we could get into the study of phonon, because glossa is used in 1421 with regard to languages, and so you have in both passages phonon, sounds which are languages, glossa, use of the tongue which are language, and by the way, phonon and glossa are both used elsewhere for languages. So he's really using sounds here, perhaps to indicate the comparison here, namely indistinct sounds, which means they're foreign and unintelligible because they're not interpreted. Here they're distinct because they're interpreted and mean. But I can see something of what you're driving at, Aaron, but I wouldn't call that a strong argument in favor of this point of view.
I'll work with it. I really okay. should think more a little bit about it. I think it's, to me, it's a real strong
argument. Well, come back.
Yeah, let me think on it.
All right. Are you talking about this one or another one?
Well, the one you're looking for.
You think, I'm not looking for any particular one.
Strong argument is
I'm looking for a strong argument for this point of view.
How about 14.2, letters and mysteries, secrets and destruction?
Well, how about it? See, what you've got to learn to do is to build an argument, you see. Draw these inferences, get the evidence, draw these inferences, and show how they answer the question in a certain way, at least seem to answer the question in a certain way. What's the meaning of tongues? Spell out the reasoning process. That's why I say what about it.
Okay, well, one, mysteries in the spirit has nothing to do with language. We've already observed and noted the role of the Spirit in static utterances with an association there. We tend to tie utterances and mysteries to the static form of the concept of the language.
Well, why do you say mysteries in the Spirit have nothing to do with language? I'm just wondering about the mysteries, because you know mysterion is a common Pauline term, and it's used in almost every other case involving, by the way, Christ and the Spirit with regard to his proclamation of the gospel was certainly involved language. Okay. As a matter of fact, there's another dimension here related to mysterion, but I think the latter kind of thing you say, if you simply set aside the mysterion as the basis for your argument, namely, if you take an absolute understanding of 14.2 and, 14.2, let's look at that first. For one who speaks in a tongue cannot possibly be speaking to men. You know, absolutely, only to God. For no one can possibly understand him. take an absolute view of those statements, then it would imply that he is speaking, that sounds are being spoken that have no possibility with regard at least to human languages. Now, of course, you have this other option here. And it could be a divine language, which would also be the case with regard to being completely beyond the possibility of comprehension by human beings. Or there would be no point in addressing it to human beings. So here again, you see, you can use this as a rebuttal for this kind of argument. But this is a strong argument, providing you use what I've indicated here, not the Musteiran, because the counter-argument here, and well, our time is about up here in terms of break at least, the counter-argument here is that understands is different from simply knowing the translation of. In fact, it's interesting that the word akuo is used here. Here means grasping the true meaning of something, not merely hearing the words and even knowing what the words mean, but getting the true grasp of something, because he's dealing with revealed secrets that have to do with the spirit. In other words, the spirit really has to give him the meaning of this. But beyond that, of course, the argument, as I indicated on this side, would be that this could be a relative statement, all made in the context that these things are true if there is no interpretation. Which, of course, really leads us to ask, what's involved in interpretation? What characteristics are involved in making these tongues, these glossa, interpretable? See? Well, begun wrestling with the evidence. The reason why we've done this with you is I'm concerned about you developing these inferential skills. That's why I pressed you so hard, Aaron. But all of us have that need, developing these inferential skills, so you really link the evidence with the answer to the question by inferential reasoning. So the reasoning is clear, how you move from the evidence to the inference, or inferences, to the answer to the question. You see? By the way, often you have two inferential stages, this stage and then this stage. Now sometimes this stage will take care of this one. The moment you draw the inference, the answer to the question becomes self-evident. But sometimes you can draw your inference and still be one or more logical steps removed from the answer to the question. Of course, the reason why you're looking at this evidence is because you're trying to answer the question. So it's developing the skills involved in inferential reasoning. And by the way, this is important not only from the standpoint of our own thinking processes, but also from the standpoint of communication, which of course is essential to ministry. You can't minister without communicating. So that's why I would press all of us not merely to have some clear idea in our minds as to how the links are made, but be able to express them. In fact, very often the latter is bound up with the former. And sometimes when you express these things, you realize that the link you had in your mind is not as clear as you thought it was, when you have to articulate it, see? This is the need that all of us have. Well, I think it's 11:06 by my watch, so let's take a break now until 11:15, and then we'll resume. Come back sharply, if you will, at 11:15.
I don't know what you're saying.
The first one about harps and flutes and bugles.
If I play a flute, if I just play a C and a B, I mean, several notes, but you can't tell there's any song to it, but, you know, no one will know what the song's about. If I don't play an arrangement, if I don't play the music market, I'm just making up my own little song, and it's not a song in at all.
I have a question. I play the trumpet, and I can play a blurb or a note. And I think what he's talking about is blurb, not note. Yes.
Which would, but that helps his argument.
Right.
Because then he's saying that language is a blurb.
Yes.
So in the case of an instrument, for example, the bugle, if I play reveille and start out with a blurb, nobody's good.
That's right.
They may wake up, but they won't
remember
about that.
So,
yeah,
that's right. And Paul's saying you've got to play the reveille if you want people to know what you're playing.
Okay, but it's not the song that's important, it's the note.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that's
okay, yes, that's right.
And that would go along with your argument.
Yeah.
And
well, how would that go along with your argument, and the argument valid? How would that go along with your argument?
Well,
I mean, what is a, in a language, what is a blurb and what is a note?
I think the emphasis we're making here is that if you don't play the reveille, if a bugle doesn't sound the reveille, the warriors won't know what's going on.
That's an indistinct sound. There's war against a distinct sound. Now, how does that relate? How is that similar to what happens with regard to languages? What's an indistinct sound with regard to a foreign language?
That's hard to
understand.
Anything they don't understand.
Isn't that the point? Isn't that the whole point here? The indistinct sound of a bugle is the indistinct sound of a foreign language. Why? Because both are intelligible. Unintelligible. Now, why is the latter unintelligible? And when is it unintelligible?
When it's not intelligible.
When it's not interpreted. See?
Yeah.
And when is it intelligible? When it's interpreted. In other words, he's and here again, you see, you have to be careful how you use analogies. This is a very tricky area, as we pointed out in interpretation. The question is, how are the two analogies related, the instrument analogy and the language analogy? Now, in the instrument analogy, he distinguishes between indistinct sounds and distinct sounds. Now, by the way, indistinct sounds, do you call it a blurb? Is that what you call it? whatever you call it. Are indistinct. Why?
Because it's not playing a known something familiar.
Yeah.
Something
well, not necessarily. But anyway, it has no meaning. I mean, it's just a honk. A distinct sound has a clear meaning. Now, by the way, he's using this in relation to the use of instruments in a certain way. He's talking about that. And there they had a certain sound that had a certain meaning with regard to going into battle. Now, if you know, a guy has the instrument and just blows any old sound, they're not going to go into battle because it doesn't mean let's go to battle. But if he plays the other note, it has the meaning that the battle is ready to begin and they're ready to fight. So, well, that's the difference between them. Now, how is this analogy like this one, with regard to language? Well, when is a language indistinct and without meaning?
When it's foreign.
Yeah, when it's foreign. In other words, it's unintelligible.
Depends on the hearer.
Yeah, it depends on the hearer, that's right. But it also depends on the speaker, in that the speaker is speaking his foreign language and not interpreting it for the hearer. Well, he says, you have to be careful with interpretation. On the other hand, when a language is distinct and has meaning, when, now, by this we mean foreign to the hearer, it doesn't have meaning, when this foreign language is interpreted, then, of course, it's distinct, it has meaning. This has no meaning, like this indistinct sound of the instrument, and this has meaning.
got to do, my question would be, with supporting this argument?
That would be the question. In spite of the use, by the way, of phonon in 1410, and by the way, here we could get into the study of phonon, because glossa is used in 1421 with regard to languages, and so you have in both passages phonon, sounds, which are languages, glossa, use of the tongue, which are language. And by the way, phonon and glossa are both used elsewhere for languages. So he's really using sounds here, perhaps to indicate the comparison here, namely indistinct sounds, which means they're foreign and unintelligible, but not interpreted here. They're distinct because they're interpreted and meaning. But I can see something what you're driving at, Aaron, but I wouldn't call that a strong argument in favor of this point of view.
I'll work with it. I really should think more a little bit about it. I think it's a real strong
one. Well, we'll come back.
Yeah, let me think on it.
All right. Are you talking about this one or another one?
Well, the one you're looking for.
You think, I'm not looking for any particular one.
A strong argument is...
I'm looking for a strong argument for this point of view.
How about 14.2, letters of mysteries, sequence of human scripts?
Well, how about it? See, what you've got to learn to do is to build an argument, you see. Draw these inferences, get the evidence, draw these inferences, and show how they answer the question in a certain way. And they seem to answer the question in a certain way. What's the meaning of tongues? So, spell out the reasoning process. That's why I say what about it.
Okay, one, mysteries in the spirit has nothing to do with language. We've already observed, noted the role of the Spirit in staff utterances. There's an association there. Two to five, utterances and mysteries in static form rather than the language.
Well, why do you say mysteries in the Spirit have nothing to do with language?
Well, it says, for no one understands him, and that is in contrast to the utterings of mysteries. As you observed earlier, you can take that no one, in the sense of no one of any languages. So that would just, that would set up the contrast languages and those who utter mysteries.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about the mysteries, because you know mysterion is a common Pauline term, and it's used in almost every other case, involving, by the way, Christ and the Spirit, with regard to his proclamation of the gospel, was certainly involved language. Matter of fact, there's another dimension here related to mysterion, but I think the latter kind of thing you say, if you simply set aside the mysterion as the basis for your argument, namely, if you take an absolute understanding of 14.2 and, 14.2, let's look at that first. For one who speaks in the tongue cannot possibly be speaking to men. Yeah, absolutely, under God. For no one can possibly understand him. You take an absolute view of those statements, then it would imply that he is speaking, that sounds are being spoken, that have no possibility with regard at least to human languages. Now, of course, you have this other option here. So could be a divine language, which would also be the case with regard to being completely beyond the possibility of comprehension by human beings. Or there would be no point in addressing it to human beings. So here again, you see, you can use this as a rebuttal for this kind of argument. But this is a strong argument, providing you use what I've indicated here, not the misleading argument, because, the counter-argument here, our time is about up here, I'm coming to break at least. The counter-argument here is that understands is different from simply knowing the translation of. In fact, it's interesting that the word akuo is used here. Here, means grasping the true meaning of something, not merely hearing the words and even knowing what the words mean, but getting the true grasp of something, because he's dealing with revealed secrets that have to do with the spirit. In other words, the spirit really has to give him the meaning of this. But beyond that, of course, the argument, as I indicated on this side, would be that this could be a relative statement, all made in the context that these things are true if there is no interpretation. Which, of course, really leads us to ask, what's involved in interpretation? What characteristics are involved in making these tongues, these glosa, interpretable? Well, we've just begun rushing with the evidence. The reason why we've done this with you is that I'm concerned about you developing these inferential skills. That's why I pressed you so hard, Aaron. But all of us have that need, developing these inferential skills, so you really link the evidence with the answer to the question by inferential reasoning. So the reasoning is clear, how you move from the evidence to the inference, or inferences, to the answer to the question. You see? By the way, often you have two inferential stages, this stage and then this stage. Now sometimes this stage will take care of this one. The moment you draw the inference, the answer to the question becomes self-evident. But sometimes you can draw your inference and still be one or more logical steps removed from the answer to the question. Of course, the reason why you're looking at this evidence is because you're trying to answer the question. So it's developing the skills involved in inferential reasoning. And by the way, this is important not only from the standpoint of our own thinking processes, but also from the standpoint of communication, which of course is essential to ministry. You can't minister without communicating. So that's why I would press all of us, not merely to have some clear idea in our minds as to how the links are made, but be able to express them. In fact, very often the latter is bound up with the former. And sometimes when you express these things, you realize that the link you had in your mind was not as clear as you thought it was. We have to articulate it. This is the need that all of us have. Well, I think it's 11:06 by my watch, so let's take a break now. It could be used for this point of view, would involve context and terms. Let me use scriptural testimony at this point. Namely, the passages in Acts 10 and 19, which it is argued would seem to be different from what you have in Acts 2, which are languages. And that can be used over there too, in terms of heavenly languages, but different in Acts 2, which involve human languages, I should say, over against other possible languages. Well, there are some other arguments that will emerge here as we look at this other side. Process of rebuttal. Let's move to the other side now. What are the indications of support for this other point of view? Sure.
Did I understand you that Acts 10 and 19 are not the same as Acts 2.
Well, that's the argument that you is here. That's debatable.
Exactly, but that, I think.
Yeah, yeah. It's debatable. That's, in fact, I tend to debate on the other side of it, although the argument here is that you didn't have the occasion and the need for the kinds of tongues that you have in Acts 2, the Acts 10 and Acts 19 situation. And you have no evidences, for example, of people of different languages being there, or evangelization through the use of languages, etc. So the argument is that you have something else again there, and it could well be ecstatic utterances or lingual sounds. Okay? Let's move now to the other side of the ledger. What are the arguments there? And we'll list some of them we've listed already. By the way, if you have, and some of these will support one or the other of these, some will support both, and we'll make a distinction by using D or H between them. The argument that might be used to support the human, the over against the divine, would involve this matter of the analogy, twofold analogy in the context. In 14, I think I have verses right, 10 to 11 is not the first one, and then in 14:21, both of which involve human languages. Particularly in connection with this concept that he goes on to discuss, namely that these are to be a sign for unbelievers. Several questions here. One involves, by the way, definition of the term sign, scriptural testimony as to the use of the term sign. Another involves the psychology of unbelievers. Particularly, and here we come to a matter of historical background here, particularly since in Corinth and elsewhere, apparently tongues, some kind of tongues, at least lingual sounds, were used in other religions besides Christian religions. In the mystery religion, for example. In the Dionysian cult and in other religions. And when you have the psychology of unbelievers who tend to be skeptical anyway, the question would be, in what sense would languages, glossa, tongues, be a sign for these skeptical unbelievers within the context of this historical background, and particularly in light of how you have the term used in the scriptures. And the argument would be you have to have several characteristics here at work in order to distinguish between, say, these false uses against this background and this use here that would really be a sign for unbelievers. If sign here means the same thing that you have in John's Gospel, and there the signs are very clear, you know, that you may believe. The very clear guideposts, indications. I would say that one of these would need to be clarity. And the question is, could simply lingual sounds be clear, especially if they were practiced by other people? A second would be perhaps verifiability of some sort. A third would be a functional kind of thing, that they would actually bring these individuals to Christ. Sign for unbelievers. By the way, there's a counter argument here, and that is that if this is involved in a sign, then either you'd have to have someone there who knew the language, in which case it would not need to be interpreted, and obviously language or the tongues need to be interpreted, or you'd have to have a linguistic expert, like Eugene Nye or someone, sit down and analyze the language and say, now there is a constant vocabulary, a constant syntax, whenever, for example, the sound da is made, that means God, consistently, etc. By the way, people like Nida have analyzed these, the use of tongues, that gets into the situation analysis in in that regard. So one could counter, well, if this is what's involved, there's no way in which it could happen. So this could not have been involved. The kind of thing that would be clear and verifiable and functional. The comeback is that this can be sensed psychologically. And by the way, I cite you evidences with regard to some who argue that by some kind of almost intuition, you sense that you're using vocabulary and syntax in a regular way, even though you don't know exactly what it means. The mind is not functioning in terms of saying, well, I know that I make this sound, it means thus and so. I know this sound with this meaning is related to this other sound with this meaning. Now, another argument here, by the way, that we should have mentioned, the argument that's often used back here is that this is involved in private use of tongues, and in that case, the sounds with a regular meaning in sentence structure is irrelevant, because you're subjectifying yourself. So you're really, for example, expressing a spirit of praise, or an overwhelming sense of the presence of God. You say it doesn't make any difference then whether it means anything or can mean anything. You have sounds. Of course, as we indicated in the structure of the segment as a whole, there is some evidence to point to the fact that you have in 14, 1-5, a general statement, which is then particularized subsequently. And subsequently, of course, the end, as is indicated in 14.5, the issue is that of interpretation in public use as over against non-interpretation. So you have to assume that what he's talking about here is within the context of the public use of these things only without interpretation. So if one speaks in a tongue without interpretation, okay, then he doesn't speak to men, but only to God. Only God can hear it. Okay. Or, in 4, he edifies himself if it's not interpreted. Interpreted, then he edifies the church. Okay. So that would be the counter argument here with regard to the passage. And that, in other words, the passage does not describe a private use of tongues as over against the public use, nor does it describe some distinctive prayer use as over against non-prayer use. And by the way, the prayer use is in the public, is clearly within the context of public use discussion in 13 following. And there's no clear-cut indication here that when he talks about praying in the tongue, which is very rare, by the way, that he's talking about praying in one kind of tongue as over against speaking in another kind of tongue. Or, for example, praying in this kind of tongue, but maybe speaking in one of these two kinds of tongues. Follow my argument? No indication of that kind of distinction here in the context. Then the argument which involves context, both segmental and intersegmental, the segmental context, the use of the plural tongues with a singular subject along with singular use with singular subject. Remember, we observed that. I may speak in a tongue or speak in tongues. Also, this, of course, is in 14. You have a similar kind of thing in 12, but also the very interesting expression in 12 in several places, various kinds of tongues. Now, this word gene is used in relation to nations and people and types. Now, what would various kinds of tongues, or what would tongues be, over against a tongue, if you're talking about sounds? I mean, is a tongue a single sound over and over again? And tongues several sounds? Or is he talking about various languages?
What is he talking about, both?
He could be talking about both, except you have to have other evidence that would support both.
Okay. You put down the Acts directly on the side, right?
Well, as I said, that's one of the strong arguments he used. It's used on this other
Acts
side.
Acts 2 also.
Well, Acts 2 is used on this side. primarily. Right?
Yeah, that's the argument for the line.
And indeed, one could argue that particularly in light of the fact that in 10, the statement is made that they received the Holy Spirit even as we did. And the fact that normally you would hypothesize a constant use of a term within a book unless there's clear evidence to the contrary. That the use in 10:9 and 19 would be similar, this is the strict testimony part, would be a similar use to Acts 2. Now, of course, the counter-argument here would be that you have one kind of tongues in Acts 2, and even if you added to that Acts 10 and 19, you have to have another kind of tongue here because this did not require interpretation in Acts 2. This requires interpretation. But then the counter-argument here, this has to do with the context, both in 12 and 14, and that has to do with the fact that this kind of tongue is interpretable. Now, what would be involved in interpreting a tongue? And by the way, hermeneuo and diermeneuo is used elsewhere with regard to translation, which means that you take a certain sound in a regular use and you associate that sound with a certain meaning, and also meaning. The question would be, what would be required of a tongue to make it interpretable? And the argument on this side would be that you have to have some kind of constant vocabulary and syntax, otherwise you're not interpreting the sounds, what you're interpreting is the spirit of the person uttering the sounds. See? So if I, you know, someone makes a sound and I'm really saying, this person is saying praise God, but what I'm saying is this person is expressing a spirit of praise, but, you know, and I remember when I was a youngster, I went to a Pentecostalist meeting and meeting, and I still remember the sounds that were made. They were made over and over again, Lucy busy. Now, if someone said Lucy busy, and someone else interpreted the sound and said, the tongues and said, this person is saying praise God, unless Lucy means either God or praise, and busy means either God or praise, depending on the order of the sentence structure, what I'm really doing is reading the person's spirit, not the sounds. Now interpretation is associated with this kind of thing.
But isn't there another argument that says that the interpretation is given by the Holy Spirit also, and therefore it's not a requirement for it to be in conjunction necessarily?
I'm not talking about who's giving it. I'm talking about what's involved in giving it, no matter who is giving it.
Well, I'm saying it may not be necessary. Yeah.
No, I don't see it. I don't think that counters this argument. And, it may be that no human being knows that Lucy busy means praise God, so the Holy Spirit has to, by the way, the power of interpretation is a different, distinct kind of power. Now, even the person speaking does not know what the person is saying, and then it needs to be a separate gift. It's included in 12, it's a separate gift. It's a gift of the Holy Spirit, can be realized through prayer. But the point, the question would be not who does the interpretation, but whoever does the interpretation, and the Spirit doing it, obviously. What is involved in the process of interpretation? Now, I've never heard a valid counter-argument to this. I've heard people try to argue against it, but I've never heard it. Maybe there is one, but I've never heard of it.
Does that mean that you're saying that the interpretation is something that is learnable? Seems to me like the argument comes down here. Is it learnable or is it not learnable? Is it a gift of God or is it a combination of a gift and talent? And that seems to be where the two groups are in conflict.
where a charismatic group will say that it's a gift of God, it's not something that can be learned. And they would use like this verse that you referred to, praying, as you can't, you know, it doesn't make sense that you can get it by learning, or you wouldn't pray for it. If you could learn it, and then this, then the text doesn't say that it's learnable anywhere in here, lastly. And that's the kind of argument that they use. So
now, by the way, some very interesting psychological studies have been done. This doesn't involve the interpretation necessarily. There are studies done on that too. But one of the findings has been that the accent of some people who speak in tongues is very like the accent of their guru. Their leader. And by the way, in many cases, when the guru passed out of the picture, the person ceased speaking in tongues. But anyway, this gets us into a whole area. But I assume what you're saying is that I'll say Luzi Busy, that's the sound I heard.
B-U-Z-I.
that if someone got up and interpreted that to mean praise God, then when someone else said Luzi Busy, a person could have learned this interpretation without the gift of interpretation, is that what you're saying? And so say, well, that person said Luzi Busy, not because the Holy Spirit is at work here through the process, but because I heard someone else say that this meant praise God when someone said Luzi Busy. Is that what you're talking about?
I'm saying if it is a human language, the language is learnable. And the question becomes, do you need to pray to be able to have that gift? And then the counter argument is, well, just for a person to be a good interpreter, it's kind of a gift too. It's also partly a talent.
Let me turn this back on.
Here. I've got jeans on.
Oh, you have. But let me pick it up. Of course, you're dealing with several issues here. One is, if it's a heavenly language, it's not learnable. It could be a language, but a heavenly language, not learnable. Or it could be an antiquated language, which is not learnable. It's dead. It's past. As a matter of fact, there's an interesting quotation in Aristotle that relates to the use of the term for dialect in Acts 2 that involves this very thing. By the way, I found this in an article on speaking with tongues from written by Frank Bear, B-E-A-R-E, in JBL, September 64. He says, there's still a third sense, which is not paralleled in the English use of the word tongue, to mean a strange, unusual, unfamiliar word, one that has become obsolete and belongs to a peculiar dialect. As I say, the interesting thing about 2.6 is that it uses dialect. And Aristotle remarks that diction may be given a certain elevation and distinction by the use of glottae, but if the speaker uses nothing else, his speech will be barbaric. So what he may be talking about is even a human tongue which is obsolete, not learnable, but which, as I say, seems to have a clear pattern of vocabulary and syntax. Now, presumably, if someone sat down, you know, with a tape recorder, which of course was not available back here, but anyway, tape recorder, and played the thing over and over again, and listened to interpretations, although this whole business of interpretation is a very tricky kind of thing. Again, in a book I read by a psychologist who looked into this whole area, the story was told of a man who went to a meeting where glossolalia were used, and he said the Lord's Prayer in Swahili. And three people got up to interpret, and none of the interpretations had anything to do with the Lord's Prayer. So, you know, whether an interpretation is an accurate rendering of whatever is being said is problematic. Who knows? No. Who knows? Really, what you have to do is to test the interpretation by the Word of God. That's about the only test you have. And you know, if it accords with the Word of God generally, whether it actually interprets the statement made is somewhat irrelevant. It's true anyway, so you take it as true. This only illustrates the great difficulties involved in this whole matter. It's an extremely complicated area. Well, let me run down a few more things here. If we have the time. Of course, the argument on this side with regard to 13.1 is that that involves a contrary to fact position. And so this would be out, see, that way of thinking. The argument on the other hand for this would be that 13.1 involves a simple condition, which means that the heavenly language is possible. I think there are those, Aaron, who would use the analogy with human languages on this side. Say that you should liken this to human languages. And by the way, it's interesting that in the Isaiah incident, the languages were not understood. That was not the issue. In fact, the whole point was there was the foreigners who were speaking a language that could not be understood, which meant that something had happened, namely what the prophet said would happen. The foreigners would come in and take them captive. See. So the idea would be that really is indicative of the very kind of thing that he is talking about. And then in terms of scriptural testimony and synonyms, there are words in the Greek that would indicate lingual sounds, such as bakalogeo, which is used in Matthew 6:7, which could have been used to indicate what's involved here, if meaning is just lingual sounds. And then you have, of course, historical phenomena, the whole phenomenon of human inducement of these things, et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, historically, you have people down through history who have known nothing of any foreign language, and all of a sudden they start to speak that foreign language fluently. Some cases, it was understood. Some cases, it was not understood. Have to be interpreted. Of course, the problem in those cases is that the interpretation wouldn't necessarily be pneumatic. It could be on the basis of human learning. Well, again, we're illustrating the process, and we're also illustrating, I hope, that some of these things aren't as clear-cut as they might seem to be. But that in itself is significant. Now, I think the weight tends to come, I emphasize, tends to come down on this side. Either one or the other up here. But I must confess that I am not at all sure of it. But even if one says it could be this as over against this, that in itself gives one a certain caution by way of proceeding in this whole area. And as I was saying to some, and I think maybe I said the class as a whole, it's important that we go through this process of looking at the evidence, even though it can't be conclusive. Simply to assume what this means, and then assume the other thing that I want to talk about here for the close of our hour, namely that what is happening contemporarily is the same as the biblical phenomenon. So to make those two assumptions, I think it's extremely dangerous. What's going on in the church. Now, what we need to do as we move to evaluation and application, although of course we don't know what the meaning is, it's a little hard to evaluate or apply, but even then there might be some value in doing situational analysis. Doing evaluation, for one thing, in terms of whether this is a contemporary gift or a gift which was given only in the past for the church, and is no longer being given. That kind of thing can be done. And without going through the whole process, it's clear, I think, that there are some gifts that are listed, even in 1 Corinthians 12, that are no longer gifts of the church, such as apostleship. But I see no clear evidence that tongues has ceased to be a gift, whatever it means, a gift to the church in the New Testament. And by the way, also in light of the contemporary situation, history in the contemporary situation, those are elements also that we have to take into account. I think the conclusion might well be that it could be a gift given now. Now, whether it is the gift that is given to a lot of people who claim the gift is another proposition, and part of that depends on situational analysis, which of course involves historical analysis, and motivational analysis, and circumstantial analysis, by the way, historical and circumstantial are very, very significant. The kind of evidence I've been citing to you, and the kind of evidence that I have been, I've looked at myself in interviewing a number of people who are Las Lelis. When I was in the dean's office, we had a policy with regard to the application form on glossolalia because of certain problems that arose here, by the way, at the seminary. I think the present generation doesn't understand what was going on here, such as the use of I won't call it glossolalia because I'm not sure it was this, but the use of something or other in the chapel in a public meeting. In fact, a man was brought in. Head of the so-called Las Lelis movement, he was doing all kinds of things. Pressure was being put on people to speak in tongues. By the way, the emphasis here is not on human inducement of pressure, but a gift of the Spirit, which is sovereignly given. He gives it to whom he wills. People in dormitories were being pressured, and they were telling the administration, either you stop this or we're going to have to move out of dormitories. So there was a real problem. And if anybody knows the history of this thing, and even contemporary situations, you know that this thing can be schismatic and divisive. It's not always divisive, fortunately, but it can be divisive. And so we saw some red flags, and we decided we ought to take some rather firm action in regard to this matter. But part of that firm action, as academic dean, I had to interview everybody who answered the class-related question in the affirmative. I ran into many, many interviewers. And it was interesting, when I talked with those people, that you had certain phenomena recurring. And one confirmed the finding of a psychologist in this whole thing, and that is that many of these people have come through some kind of trauma. Divorce, some kind of trauma that made them open to an unusual kind of experience. Another thing is that this very often was associated with some kind of guru who came in the context, very often, not always, but very often, in the context of others doing it too. Well, sometimes it was a very private kind of thing all of a sudden, very often in the context of other people doing it too. When these people were asked about the nature of the experience, most of them answered on the side of language, but didn't know why. Myself, they said, I feel it's a language. Now, let me just speculate as to a possibility. Let's just assume for the moment that the biblical evidence tends to come down on this side. It may be that what is happening for most people, I say most, not all, but most people, is this kind of phenomenon. And it may be that the Holy Spirit is behind it. Not all of it, but I can't talk about percentages, but a great deal of it. Which is quite possible. And by the way, of course, one of the elements one finds too, at least I found, and others have found, and that is that this kind of phenomenon tends to be used as a crutch. It'll loop.